The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong from the nation's capital. I'm seated in a beautiful lawn area just in front of the Capitol reflecting pool in Washington, D.C. on a very beautiful, pleasant day, the very first of June of 1975, having just returned from Europe, where I have witnessed the assembled heads of state inside one of the main conference rooms at NATO headquarters for the NATO summit meeting. And now the United States of America enters one of the most crucial crises of all of our history as this nation prepares for its bicentennial. Washington, D.C. right now is a city of feverish activity preparing for the bicentennial observation, and that is to be seen in the fantastic amount of construction going on. They're trying frantically to rush through an awful lot of preparation for that bicentennial, not only here, but up and down the length and breadth of the country in many historical spots. And, of course, almost anyone who is planning to do anything at all in the media will be paying special note to various historical occasions as the 200th anniversary rolls along. We've already seen the passage, for example, of the 200th anniversary of Paul Revere's ride. And almost daily in the newspapers, you'll be reading of something which reflects back on American history. But today, in this turbulent world of nuclear overkill, and with a president not clearly the elected majority choice of the American public, but nevertheless the president of the United States, I think it's time to reflect not only on the past of the United States, but on the immediate future. Why a crisis of leadership? Simply because we have suffered so many agonizing reversals over the past few years, especially Vietnam, and we all know it so well. The absolute incredible bruise and injury to our national spirit that was Watergate. A word that somehow is never going to completely fade from the American consciousness and conscience. Perhaps the media is partly to blame, but it isn't a matter of name-calling and blame-placing now, but a time to forget the recriminations of the past and to go on and to face the immediate future and the challenges that are presented to us, and to do it with resolve and with strength and with unanimity of purpose. I have heard a very strong president. I have seen a very strong president, Gerald Ford, in action, on the spot, in Europe. And I was very proud and I was very impressed. Yet when I see others calling Mr. Ford a weak man, I have to clarify what they mean, because if I am repeating the words of the press by asking a European leader, what is your view of a comparatively weak president, a divided Congress, and a reluctant popular majority of the people involving American troop commitments abroad, I mean to put that in journalistic language of the way most people would approach the current leadership situation in the United States. They would refer to Mr. Ford as a weak president merely because he is not an elected official. But let me tell you, he is anything from a weak personality or a weak individual. When you actually see him stride into the room and see almost automatically and spontaneously a large majority of the assembled delegates involving 13 prime ministers, the entire military delegation of the top admirals and generals of all the combined NATO armed forces come to their feet, as they do for no other leader, and you see all eyes on this man, and you recognize a kind of an electricity in the air as he and Mr. Kissinger enter, you're somehow made a little proud of the fact that still, in spite of the horrible problems that we have suffered abroad, the agony of Vietnam, Europeans look to the United States for leadership. We have yet to see whether or not that's what they're going to receive. A crisis of leadership worldwide is what we face right now, and perhaps we're facing it at a very handicapped moment, with the scars of Watergate deeply etched into our consciousness, with the fact of a president in office who was not the elected official of a clear-cut majority of public opinion. But nevertheless, if we fail to pass this crisis and this test of leadership, then the future for the United States of America is terribly uncertain and very dark indeed. I talked to the Belgian Prime Minister only a few days ago, and I asked him directly what was his impression of Gerald Ford as a character, as a man. The Belgian Prime Minister was very impressed, and it was obvious. He spoke of Mr. Ford's personal magnetism, of the type of open-minded and the open-hearted and honest approach that he seemed to have to world problems and to those that were the united problems of European countries and America alike, especially in the configuration of NATO. And I was very pleased to hear that that was the kind of an impression that the American president was making on leaders abroad. As you know, he stopped off in Spain, and then he went to Austria. And now what happens points up something which to me may reflect back even on the media and on the press in general and on photographers in particular with regard to Watergate. I do not understand why it seems to be almost like an American pastime to nitpick, to blame place, to name call, to try to, as it were, undress public officials in public, to lampoon, to ridicule, to poke fun at officials, elected officials or unelected officials, makes no difference. Any authority symbol, any institution that stands for something solid, that stands for something permanent or something that is of value, it seems to be a national pastime. We must rip it down. We must ridicule it and impugn it. I was incensed, I might say mildly outraged, to see on the front page of the Washington Post this morning two pictures of the President of the United States. Here in the nation's capital, seated on this lawn, looking right now at the beautiful dome of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., and at the big cumulus clouds in the background, hearing the noise of traffic passing by behind me as it flows around from Pennsylvania Avenue and on across the bridge over toward Washington National Airport. Once in a while, you might hear motors in the background, you might hear a siren, you might hear the sounds of a busy city, and you might even hear jets overhead as they depart or arrive at the Washington National Airport, not far across the river from here. But you know, I am filled with a feeling of a kind of a national pride, of a kind of a patriotism, as I am here at the nation's capital, and when I see pictures of our president on his hands and knees at the foot of a ramp of our own presidential airplane in Austria, I am absolutely incensed. Incensed not because the man slipped, because he's got a football knee, and because he's got a great deal of fatigue and incredible schedule working his head off over there. And anyone could have slipped down a very rain-soaked, old, frayed carpet that they wheel up to an airplane, very steep, no doubt, too, in a driving rain. You could have, I could have. But I'm incensed because that is the picture they chose to publish. Instead of pictures of our president standing tall and proud, and he is tall and a big man, instead of pictures of handshakes or pictures of deliberation or a picture of intense look as he concentrates on a problem of really global magnitude. No, our press, which is a free press, and that's fine, we can talk on that later perhaps, but our press chose to publish the pictures of the President of the United States slipping down a few rungs of a ladder and falling to his hands and knees, and they made quite a deal over it, too, in the Washington Post newspaper, and I'm pretty sure, knowing our penchant for that type of thing, that you saw those pictures, no matter how tiny the hometown newspaper may be. I'm sure they'll be circulated worldwide. You know, back during World War II and before, during the Roosevelt administration, I don't believe the American public ever saw President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in a wheelchair, and yet that's where he spent his adult life. They would always see him behind the dais or the podium. They would see a full bust view with just the face. They would see him seated. They would see his face in a newsreel motion picture. But they would never see a crippled president. Suddenly, all of this has changed. Everything is different now. If you find someone making a gesture, yawning, I can tell you from personal observation when I was over there in the press box at the NATO summit conference that every time Henry Kissinger would move, every time Gerald Ford would blink, once he blinked or appeared to close his eyes or would rub his hands together, any kind of a gesture, and the cameras just went crazy. And of course, many of them are these very rapid-firing automatic 35mm that are used by the press these days. And they have a mechanical motor that makes quite a clack and quite a sound. It takes a picture, flips the shutter, and then, of course, winds and cocks it for the next picture all at once, very, very suddenly. And at one time, the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, leaned back, reached or groped for a handkerchief, and appeared about ready to blow his nose. And so as he did, you could not believe the sight in the press gallery. A couple of dozen cameras are waiting for this great event. Nobody is listening to any of the speeches being made, and when Mr. Kissinger did precisely that, wham, I imagine about 200 pictures were taken in the space of about 3 seconds. personally, I don't understand it. I have said time and again on this program, just because it happens, it's not necessarily news. The good Lord, as some people call him, I say God or our Savior Christ, did not design or equip the human body with a see-through stomach, and I can be thankful for that. I don't want to see what you ate for breakfast, and I'm not really anxious to even see what I ate for breakfast. And there are some things we do in private and things that happen in society, whether we're talking about crime and ugly, hideous things that happen to people, or whether we're talking about accident, that is not good for the rest of us to see. We have doors on our bathrooms and drapes on our windows. We have privacy. And it seems to me that a president of the United States, who is the emissary of us all, who is over there talking with European leaders and is trying desperately to patch together a tremendous amount of broken pride for Uncle Sam, is over there trying to exert leadership to, again, get European governments that are very, very doubtful about American commitments and American support and may be deciding to go it alone. We may be seeing a United States of Europe emerging. We see deep recession and deep economic problems and unemployment inside those European countries, and there may be severe economic and political as well as military consequences as a result of all of that. Gerald Ford needs our support. I'm not saying the man is perfect, and I'm not saying I'm a Republican or that you should be. I'm saying whichever president is especially dealing with foreign policy, and when he's abroad, then the American people need to be united in their support of him. And to me, it is ludicrous that the press would choose those particular pictures to display a moment of awkwardness when they should have been showing stature and dignity, firm control, leadership. You can accomplish a great deal with what I call pictorial psychology. You can literally take people apart by simply showing their mouths moving, and these cameras are so rapid that as you're pronouncing Peter Piper pick a peppers or whatever you want to say, you're going to find that if someone were taking pictures of you with the incredible speed up to 500ths or even 1,000th of a second that these camera lenses and shutters can work on, that you're going to look like an absolute fool. Anyone who is in photography and journalism knows that that is exactly what they can do. If some official is breakfasting on cornflakes and a little bit of milk is dribbling down his lip, that's the picture they may choose to publish if they decide to make him look like a braying ass in public. If someone is falling down a flight of stairs, instead of just waiting and being sorry that that happened and hoping that he's all right and realizing it was a little lapse of dignity and certainly embarrassing to the man, no, they take pictures of it and then they splash it on the front page. That's not the picture I wanted to see. And to me, it is illustrative of a kind of an attitude in our country, an attitude that I believe the press and the media has that is a wrong attitude. I believe they need more of an attitude of respect. God's word commands that we give respect to our fellow human being, but it commands even more than that. It says we are to believe the best. It says we're to hope the best, to look for truth, to look for equity, look for justice and mercy, and then to be shocked, disappointed, or surprised when we don't find it. But it seems we're on some insane binge here of looking for the evil, of looking for everything that is wrong. There are people who literally have made up their minds that Gerald Ford is in office as a result of virtually being bought, and that there was a secret deal. They're convinced of it. They don't have any evidence. They have not one single shred of documented proof. They don't have a tape, a document, a whisper, a friend, even anyone with whom to share the opinion. They communed not with documentation or statistics. They communed with themselves. They looked inside themselves and decided that Gerald Ford is very likely guilty of some kind of a secret deal with Richard Nixon, so that the minute Ford got in and Nixon had already been ousted, that Gerald Ford would turn around and give him presidential pardon so he didn't have to go to jail. And, of course, there are many people who desperately want Nixon in jail. And some of them may have cheated on their income tax. They may be liars, hypocrites, cheats, and thieves. They may be double-minded. They may be people who have all kinds of insane personal and private habits. They may be people who just break with impunity the Ten Commandments of God and even the laws of the land. They may be everything from speeders to shoplifters. But they want Richard Nixon in jail. You know, one time I was in New York City, and it was right during the agony of the last moments of Richard Nixon's tenure in office, and you may have seen the big electronic news flasher that parades the words clear around the corner up there on Times Square. Well, I was visiting a radio station at the time, and just as I came out of that radio station and was trying to hail a cab to go back to my hotel, which was clear across over in Teterboro, we had stopped over there by the airport, and we were over in Teterboro, which is clear across in New Jersey. So I finally got a cab. But just as I was getting in a cab and we started driving down the street, the news about Mr. Nixon's resignation was being flashed. And here were all these people staring up at this sign. And I looked around, and this was the most filthy, the most unbelievable part of New York City you've ever seen. There were pornographic bookstores and peep shows and things of this nature in all directions. It looked like the most ugly, run-down, commercial honky-tonk tourist trap you ever saw in your life. Undoubtedly, many of the people on the street were pimps and prostitutes and hookers and thieves and pickpockets and whatnot. And here was a struggling mass of humanity standing there in all this trash and filth of this incredibly ugly city. And New York City deserves an awful lot of commentary here lately, even the fact of the bankruptcy virtually of the city and the incredible cutback in services, but that's another subject. My analogy was merely that of the statement I've made in the program of our space program, our space race, that it appeared that man was standing knee-deep in garbage and sending rockets at the moon. Well, here were New Yorkers standing knee-deep in the garbage and the trash of all of society and staring up at the news as it came out that a president had had to resign because he had tried to cover up a horrible deal that came to his attention that some of his aides had concocted. Now, no one has ever accused Richard Nixon of actually concocting the entire thing, including the famous break-in and all of that type of thing, but at least they feel that he did cover up, and of course that was admitted in the tape itself. But to me, there is a tremendous measure of self-righteousness and of hypocrisy in all of that, in the attitude of people. I had said time and again, don't you believe in your own mind and heart that Richard and Pat Nixon cried in each other's arms? Don't you think that man was just virtually a broken man, that he was about to have a complete and total nervous breakdown, that his mind was just about driving him insane? Don't you believe that the human being that is Richard Nixon had had so many absolute, unbelievable, nightmarish fears and thoughts and doubts and qualms and apprehensions over the future that he was a tormented, wretched individual? I frankly believe that. I believe the man suffered and suffered beyond perhaps anything you can know. And I really do believe that he suffered more than many criminals who have committed murder and even mass murder have ever been made to suffer, even by our society. I'll tell you why. On programs upcoming on the telecast, you will actually see interviews, including Charles Manson. And you will see completely unrepentant mass murderers. There was one person interviewed who had slain two policemen. And he was absolutely unremorseful. He did not care that those two policemen had died at all. And he very cheerfully says so, and I have the interview for the program. So on the other hand, we have people who will take a human life and who are completely unrepentant, and we will see usually a murderer or a criminal who is about to go to an electric chair. I remember the famous case of Carroll, I believe he pronounced his name, and maybe he was effeminate, I don't know. But anyway, Carroll Chessman. He was called the Red Light Bandit. He had raped and kidnapped, and he had done so with the aid of a siren and a red light, so he was called the Red Light Bandit. That was a sensational case in California years ago. Well, it had been tried and retried. I forget the details. All I know is there were several victims lying in his wake, among them a teenage girl, and right now as I'm talking to you, no doubt that woman is probably up in her 30s or even early 40s. She was driven completely insane by the murderous attack of the man Chessman. She lost her mind snapped, and she had to be institutionalized, where she just moans and looks out with hurt and bewildered eyes, uncomprehending, not much consciousness, if any, and more like an animal than a human being. No one really talked very much about the victim. I don't know how long the trial went, whether there was one, then another, or what, but I know that finally he was sentenced to the electric chair during the administration of Governor Brown, the father of the present governor of California. And you couldn't believe it. There were people in the press, it wasn't only the attorney for the defense, but all kinds of people. There were clubs or movements getting started. There were placards, oh, they just got to spare Carroll Chessman's life. No one said one word about the victims. It's hard to imagine that kind of an attitude that people get into when a life has been taken, not one, but sometimes many. And then the idea is there should be absolutely no punishment, and we've got to spare this criminal, and we can have sob sisters and fantastic stories and all kinds of character witnesses, and he was always a good boy from a relative and that type of thing. to try to get him off. But let the highest elected official of the United States of America, the president in office, do something that was wrong, admittedly wrong. And I've never said that two wrongs make a right, so I want to clarify as I'm sitting here in the grassy area by the reflecting pool right in front of the nation's capital with the traffic signs in the background to once again tell you where I am and doing this broadcast for those of you who might have tuned in late. I've never said two wrongs make a right, and I don't intend to say so now. I am merely saying, for the record, that if you were to know the private lives and the personal habits as well as the behind-the-scenes deals and the kind of talk and the kind of manipulation in this and that circumstance that went on behind the scenes in any administration in the past, all the way back to Washington and Jefferson, you'd probably be dumbfounded. And it's very likely that you would find an awful lot of skeletons in an awful lot of closets. Now, I'm not saying anyone should do that. I think it would be an exercise in futility and would actually hurt the country should it be done. But I'm saying it's absolutely hypocritical and ridiculous beyond belief for the nation to be ripping and tearing to shreds at Richard Nixon even long after the man has been removed from office. And by the same token, at the precise time when the United States of America faced a gigantic test of leadership around the world with horrible reversals in Southeast Asia, with the deep, severe problem of the Middle East squarely in our laps, and apparently the world looking to us, looking to Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford and members of our own government to try to arbitrate or to try to be conciliators. And here as we approach the bicentennial anniversary of the United States of America, we all ought to be seriously reflective about our nation's past and really wondering about this nation's future. Where do we go from here? The Europeans are looking for leadership. If the American public opinion were solidly behind Gerald Ford, there would be no doubts. He's saying the right things. He's doing the right things. He sounds, he looks, he talks, he acts like a leader. The only reason there is doubt in the middle echelon inside Europe is because of the press that reports American public opinion. If a poll in the United States shows that only 39% of our citizens would support American military commitment or involvement abroad in the case of some brushfire war of a type, that's weakening. If they show a divided Congress that is a do-nothing Congress, as chastised recently by Gerald Ford, and I congratulate him for it, that is weakening to his image abroad. If they show all kinds of doubts, if they see that the United States of America is not really trusting of its own leaders, that weakens the country abroad. I have never been an advocate of washing the national dirty linen in the eyes of the entirety of the world. I don't understand why the American press was so absolutely bent on opening up every last juicy little detail of Watergate before the eyes and the stunned ears of the entirety of this world. But it was. It was published on every front page in every newspaper from the tiniest country to the greatest, until the entirety of the world could look on with bemused eye at all of the antics of this country as we sought to tear ourselves apart. It would seem to me that if we are one great family, we could handle our family matters privately without letting our neighbors know about it. If you're having a family fight, you're having to chastise your son or your daughter, or the husband and the wife aren't getting along, keep it to yourselves. Don't run out in the street and scream and yell and invite all the neighbors down the block to come and hear about all your personal wretched problems. I couldn't understand then why we had to wash all of our filthy, dirty linen in world public opinion, so that everybody in the world could come to some conclusion about it one way or the other. It has dramatically weakened the United States' position of leadership in the eyes of many, many nations all around the world. Whether or not we're ever going to really sufficiently recover from the horrible, devastating blow that has done to us, I don't know. But I have said that Watergate has done us more damage than all of the combined other incidences that you could ever mention, such as the Bay of Pigs disaster, and they're still beating that one over the head and talking about the alleged part that Kennedy may have had in trying to arrange a Castro assassination. You see, every time you pick up a paper, somebody is attacking the CIA, attacking the FBI, attacking the Justice Department, they're attacking some bureau of government, they're attacking the president, attacking the Congress, they're attacking somebody, somewhere, some institution. So all of our institutions are suspect. Everybody is being attacked, and we've got the idea that if it happens, it's news. At a precise time when this nation needs to be together as never before, it is nevertheless being divided and ripped apart by all of his nitpicking that we're indulging in. Well, here we are in Washington, D.C., having returned from a very productive trip in Europe, where I saw President Ford, along with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, in a room with the assembled heads of state of the NATO nations. I heard his opening address at the airport and was there for his arrival, and was broadcasting from on the spot there, a program I hope that all of you were able to hear. And now, in the nation's capital, you see all the busy signs of preparation for the bicentennial, the celebration of the 200th anniversary of the United States of America, by July 4th, 1976. And we'll be working on our own hour color television special to celebrate that event as well. By that time, I think it'll be really driven deeply into all of our consciousness of our history, but also we probably ought to be reflecting very seriously about our immediate future. One reason I have stopped here is because of the Futurist Conference that is underway in Washington, D.C., and listening to some of these gentlemen of science talking about prognostications for the future involving crime, sociology, involving the size and scope of our cities, even advocating cities that are on floats and being towed around from one Atlantic port to another. You can't believe some of the dreams and the utopian schemes they have for the future. But it would behoove you to really wonder about the future at a time when we're under a crisis of leadership in the world abroad. And as a microcosm of that crisis is the crisis Gerald Ford himself as an individual faces. If he meets the crisis and does prove to be a strong president, the chances are good he'll run for election and win in his own right in 1976. If he does that, that's going to be good for the United States. But you know, I don't believe he's got a chance as long as the press and practically everybody else continues this needling game of trying to belittle, to make as undignified and weak-looking as they possibly can the president of the greatest country on the face of the earth. The speeches over there in Europe all say that. When I talked to the Belgian Prime Minister, he talked about the awesome responsibilities of the most important job on the face of the earth. That's the way European leaders look at the presidency of the United States of America. It does, really. Maybe I'm going on a little too long about it. Some people might get irritated with that. Sorry, but I'll just tell you that when I see photographers snapping pictures of our president falling to his knees and having to be helped by other people as he arrives at the airport to visit a foreign dignitary, it does really just mildly outrage me. I would far rather see a picture of him standing tall, dignified, and straight, with a real look of determination on his face, and see the President of the United States in two falling pictures, side by side, on the front page of the leading daily in the nation's capital. That kind of journalism, I don't think we need. This is Garner Ted Armstrong from Washington, D.C., saying you ought to write for the current number of The Plain Truth and get your name on a mailing list to get these articles coming from this Futurist Conference, as well as follow-up articles in the wake of Gerald Ford's trip abroad to Austria, to Spain, and to the nation of Belgium, where I was present. While you're at it, you ought to request the booklet called Why Prophecy, and the brand new booklet just off the press, a shortened, up-to-the-moment booklet of an earlier, much larger one called The United States and the British Commonwealth in Prophecy. We're looking backward at 200 years history. It's time we look forward into Bible prophecy. What is going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, and 25 years? The futurists in Washington, D.C. are wondering about that. But you, when you read The Plain Truth in these booklets, can know. Until next time, from the lawn in front of the reflecting pool, looking at the nation's capital on a beautiful day in Washington, D.C., this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.